Support for WPR comes from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, with Industry Demo Day, June 21st. Hands-on demonstrations and educational sessions of clean energy technologies. TheEnergyFair.org.
Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start the show today by talking about some efforts to track fish in the Great Lakes, part of a big research project. And our guest is Christopher Vandergroot. Chris is director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. And we'll find out about that system and a whole lot more about Great Lakes fish management as we talk with him. And I hope you'll join in. Are you concerned maybe about fish populations in the Great Lakes, especially Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, maybe Lake Erie if you're a walleye fisherman in particular? You give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Chris Vandergroot, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, good morning, Larry, and I appreciate you inviting me on.
You know, acoustic telemetry, that's part of the name of the group. And maybe we should just start out with a description of what the heck is acoustic telemetry.
Okay, sure. So like if you watch, you know, a nature show and you watch them tracking like bears or elk or whatnot, they typically use what we would refer to as radio telemetry. That's where an animal is given a collar or a transmitter, and the way they track them is using radio waves. Well, acoustic telemetry actually works underwater. So the fish that we are tracking and watching move around the Great Lakes Basin actually have a transmitter attached to them, either externally or internally using a surgical procedure. And then there are a bunch of receivers deployed throughout the Great Lakes Basin. So if you're in Lake Erie, there are quite a few acoustic receivers deployed there. Yeah. And if you're in, other areas like Southern Lake Michigan, there aren't a whole lot there. So in order to track the movements of these fish, there needs to be an acoustic receiver deployed underwater to monitor if a fish is moving around in the area. And I'll just note that it differs from satellite telemetry, which like if you're watching Discovery Channel or something like that, where they're tracking the sharks, most of the times those are using a GPS satellites to track the movements around. So we're not using satellites. Again, this is acoustic telemetry where you have individual transmitters and receivers, and they have to be underwater in order for those signals to be transmitted and then received.
Well, I want to talk some more about those, but first let's talk about the system itself, the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. And how did it get started? What's the history? I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, so let's start in 2010. In 2010, funding from the Great Lakes Research Initiative was secured by the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, the GLFC, to kind of demonstrate the potential of using acoustic telemetry to tag and monitor fish in the Great Lakes Basin. So this all started with four projects and, you know, a couple hundred receivers. The four projects revolved around walleye, lake sturgeon, lake trout, and then sea lamprey, which of course I'm sure you're familiar are invasive to the Great Lakes. And so the reason for this was is they wanted to be able to get, you know, information on these native fish populations, and then as well as use telemetry to understand the movements of sea lamprey to better inform control efforts.
And it's grown from there, from four to now. I was looking on your site there. There's a heck of a lot of projects going on.
There are. To be quite honest with you, I think, you know, we didn't understand. I think we understood the potential, but what we really didn't grasp was how much the managers, you know, found value in this. So I work for Michigan State University as a researcher, and this project where this collaborative is funded through the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. So the Great Lakes Fishery Commission helps coordinate research on the Great Lakes Basin. But it's the individual management agencies that have the management authority that set regulations and things of that nature. So really what we've found through time is that the managers have found great utility in using this technology. So back in 2010, I was actually a fisheries biologist for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources working on Lake Erie. And my questions were kind of pretty simple. How many of these fish migrate out of Lake Erie? And then what are their survival rates? I didn't really care about all the, you know, fancy things we're finding out, like the thermal use, you know, and things of that nature. My objectives were pretty simple. But I think that kind of hit on, you know, the fact that we could use acoustic telemetry to address management questions and needs that the traditional fishery surveys were not able to address. You know, if you go out and drag a trawl, you might see how many fish are in an area, or if you set, you know, an experimental gill net, or you do some electrofishing. These are just basically taking a snapshot. By tagging these fish and monitoring their movements, you know, we're getting a very good idea of what these fish are doing on very short time frames. Like, and sometimes we are seeing these things every 2 minutes when they're in an area where there's a lot of receiver, and we can actually estimate the precise location of those fish. In other areas, depending upon the array, we're seeing these fish every 2 to 3 to 4 weeks. So, I mean, think about this. You can understand where a fish is in a small area every minute, you know, how long as the fish is there, like how it's moving around a reef when it's there to spawn or in a river, you know, or we can track an individual walleye in the case of Lake Erie or Green Bay, get an idea where they are every 2 weeks for 4 years, as long as that battery lasts. And then when we're tracking things like lake sturgeon, they can handle a much larger tag. So now you know where that lake sturgeon is, say every 2 to 3 weeks for 10 years. So this is just giving the fisheries biologists insight into the ecology, the biology, and the population dynamics of these fish that is unprecedented, to be quite honest with you, particularly in the Great Lakes Basin.
Yeah, if you go on to that site, I was amazed at looking at Erie and Huron and Ontario. I mean, it looks like those lakes are completely covered with telemetry devices. And then in Michigan, I mean, there's spots, you know, concentrated spots in Lake Michigan and in Lake Superior.
Yeah. You want to know the reason for that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So like in Lake Erie and Lake Huron and Lake Ontario, they're studying fish that have a very broad movement patterns, right? Like we find Lake Erie can move from one end of the lake to the other in a matter of a few weeks, 2 weeks. And in fact, if a fish really gets the unction to go, they can go down there in a couple of days. Well, it goes back to what species we're monitoring. So like in Lake Huron, we're monitoring lake trout, lake whitefish, walleye. These are very large, expansive movement patterns. So that's why the entire lake is what we call wired. And so those receivers are anywhere from 10 to 15 kilometers apart, you know, in the open basin. And then in some of the smaller, you know, like in the western end of Lake Erie or in Green Bay, they're more dense, right? And in Saginaw Bay. Now in Lake Michigan is a little bit interesting and a little bit different than the other lakes because, you know, the open waters of Lake Michigan is, you know, I don't mean to sound negative, but like the open waters are like a bathtub, right? In terms of there's not much productivity there, very clear. Contrast that with Green Bay, where there's a lot of nutrients. It's more like a farm pond. So what we find is that the fish densities are highest in like Green Bay, and that's where a lot of the activity is. And then on the other side of the lake, of course, in Traverse Bay, very similar situation. Out in the open water, we don't think and we don't seem to see much movement of like walleye into the main lake of the basin. That's really more for like where the salmon are running around. And so thus far, there really aren't many salmon projects other than in Lake Ontario in the Great Lakes. And so I, as the need or the interest increases for salmon, I could see that, you know, the arrays expanding in Lake Michigan, very similar to what you see in the other lakes. Right now, we're at a kind of almost at a capacity issue. We've almost tapped our abilities to deploy and maintain receivers. And we do that with the great assistance of the large vessel program through the U.S. Great Lakes Science Center, which is actually stationed in Ann Arbor, Michigan, as well as the different management agencies, Wisconsin DNR, Michigan DNR, and so on and so forth across the basin.
Our guest today, Chris Vandergroot, he's director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System, and they're doing some really cool work in all of our Great Lakes in monitoring fish movements and activities. Questions for him, maybe about the project itself or maybe just about the fish. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. How are the devices that are in the water, how are they? Are they wired up together? They're not wired up together. I'm sure they got to be standing alone somehow, aren't they?
That's correct. So when you're talking about telemetry and acoustic telemetry, there's two major categories we have. We have what we call passive receivers and active receivers. Active receivers were literally we would go out to the river or to on the lake somewhere, drop a receiver in the water and listen for that signal, much like you would do like with the radio telemetry where you see them waving that big wand around, you know, the one that we used to have on top of our houses way back when, right? So you don't have that wand because you're not looking through for the signal through the air, of course, with acoustic telemetry, but you literally would just drop that hydrophone down in the water and listen. With the passive receivers, what we do is we generally deploy these on the lake bottom. So there's a couple different ways we would deploy them. Either A, we deploy them where there's a mooring and then there's a long rope and then another mooring or another anchor. And the receiver is deployed on one of those moorings, and then we'll drift through and snag that line, pull everything up to the boat, up in the boat, download the data, change out the batteries, and put the device back down. Or they have what we call acoustic releases built into them, where we'll deploy the unit, it will sit there, we'll go back, send a code, the unit will come back up to the surface, we'll download the data, change out the batteries, and then redeploy it. So it's kind of like having the passive telemetry is kind of like having somebody, and forgive this analogy, sitting under the water with a pair of glasses looking to see who's passing by. So the way this conceptually works, I'm sure you're familiar in the Chicago area with like the Easy Pass system, or on the tolls and whatnot. So think of yourself as a fish, and you've been tagged. If you have one of those little transducers in your car, a little box, and then the toll booths or where you're driving under are the actual receivers. And so we're able to get an idea of where fish go if they get within a certain vicinity of each of these receivers. And then that varies. If you have a very small tag, that tag may only be heard a couple hundred meters away. And if you have a very large tag, like I was talking about with the lake sturgeon, that may be up to a kilometer or a kilometer and a half away, depending upon the water conditions. Where the water is very clear and is not turbid, meaning it doesn't have a lot of dissolved stuff in it, not the farm pond, detection range is usually really good. And then when you have like the more productive systems where there's more stuff in the water, then the detection range is a lot less, it's reduced. And then it also depends like with boat noise. Like if we're doing work in the spring where guys are walleye fishing on the reefs, I can't hear any tags going off because the underwater sound from the transducers actually is actually interfering with the signal, and we can't hear the fish real well. So again, because it's underwater, it's subject to the properties that kind of either enhance or thwart sound moving through the water column.
Chris Vandergroot, that's really cool. Chris Vandergroot is director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System, taking a look at fish and fish movements in our Great Lakes and we haven't zeroed in on any of them, but we're probably most interested in Michigan and Superior, but and Erie, because there are a lot of walleye fishermen out there who travel to Lake Erie for that. You can join in. What questions do you have about fish in the Great Lakes? The number is 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. having some fun today talking about some research going on in the Great Lakes with Chris Vandergroot. He directs the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. Again, questions about the fish of the Great Lakes or about the research, I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I was kind of amused as I was reading online your paper. You were talking about the writing about the telemetry, the systems, and they said they're designed to minimize interference with all other projects. And then in parentheses, it said destructive tag collisions.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered what the heck that was.
Wow, you really want to get in the weeds today, don't you? Yeah. So the way that works actually is if you have too many fish in an area that are tagged, the signals collide with one another and they literally will knock each other out, just like bumper cars. So if you have one fish in an area, it takes a second or two for that tag to actually transmit so that the receiver can receive it and decode it. But if you have a lot of fish in a small area, it's kind of like going to like a, I don't know, some type of event, you know, in a big hall where you can't hear anything. You know, you can only hear what's really close by you. You got a lot of noise competing, right? So that's exactly what it works in. So what my job is as director is to kind of coordinate among these projects to make sure that not too many fish are being tagged in a defined in a small area so that it's interfering with the objectives of other projects. And so I use the word objectives because all these projects, it's not like, hey, I wonder what walleye do, or I wonder what lake trout do. Each of these projects have a specific and a unique set, sometimes overlapping, of objectives of what they're trying to accomplish with their project. And so we don't want one project interfering with the objectives of another project.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I as I was looking at some of the projects, I thought one had to do with estimating metabolic rates in walleye, and I thought, how the heck, you know, estimating metabolic rates in a fish, you typically have to have some sort of closed system, if I'm not mistaken. And pressure and so forth. So,
yeah. So you're kind of right on. You're right on cue there. So there's two components, I believe, to that study. So one is actually seeing what these fish are doing out in the lake. And so these transmitters, we talked about the transmitters emit this code, and it goes out, right? And it says, "Here I am." Well, some of these transmitters also have unique sensors built into them. And so one of these sensors is an accelerometer sensor. So it tells how fast a fish is swimming at a given point. So every time that fish transmits a signal, it's also sending a little piece of data that says, and by the way, this is how fast I'm moving. So that what they use is they use how fast the fish are moving at those different areas and or out for the course of a day, a week, or a month. And then at the same time, some of these transmitters actually have the ability to record depth. Like there's a pressure sensor on it so I can tell how deep in the water column they are, whether the fish are near the bottom or up near the surface, or if that varies, you know, what we call horizontal movements. They also have temperature sensors. So I don't actually do research anymore. I sit down and make sure everybody keeps playing nicely and do email and fill out budget. So these researchers can say, hey, what temperature is this fish occupying? And how does that change? And so like in a place like Lake Superior, you know, during the summer, it's pretty much the same temperature from bottom to surface to the bottom, right? Because it's the lake is mixed. You know, where they are in the water column, you're probably gonna get a very similar temperature reading. Contrast that with like Green Bay or Lake Erie or Lake Huron, where the lake stratifies, where there's warm water and then cold water. So if a fish is at one location, we don't know if it doesn't have a depth sensor on it, whether it's near the surface or at the bottom. So combining the temperature data and the pressure data gives us a better idea of what their behavior and what their activity looks like. And so, again,
That's really interesting.
It's mind-blowing, and to blow your mind maybe just a hair bit more, they actually came out a few years ago with a sensor that is a digestion sensor, so that when we're tagging like smolts and they're starting to reintroduce Cisco into the Great Lakes. Yeah. The Cisco were once the forage base. So we put these transmitters in these smaller fish, even in yellow perch. If they're eaten as that fish is being digested by the predator, there's a little enzyme on that transmitter. And when that enzyme, when the stomach enzymes digest the transmitter, it emits a new code. So now it's basically saying, it says, I've been eaten. So now we know when we're able to determine when that fish was at liberty and then when that fish was in captivity in the stomach of a predator. And so while this is really cool, right, you can only imagine how this information can be used by managers for estimating like stocking survival rates. Hey, how many of these fish are we releasing are actually, you know, surviving to whatever endpoint we're interested in? And if predation is an issue in this area or with this type of stocking, maybe we can modify our stocking practices. So maybe we stock offshore instead of onshore. Maybe we stock at night instead of during the day and vice versa. So this information, again, it goes back to what are the management questions and how can we help them address them?
I'm wondering, you know, the whole tagging process, do you have any sense on mortality and the tagging process itself and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it depends who's doing it. No. So that's one of the things we do is like, so whenever you tag a fish, right, your assumption is that a tagged fish behaves just like the other fish out there. So generally when you tag a fish, you actually what we call censor the data. We generally don't look at what it's doing for the first, you know, maybe, you know, few days or a few, you know, a couple weeks, because there's an assumption that it may have affected the behavior of that fish, right? And so if we're tracking an individual fish and we see that it doesn't move, we can assume, oh, that fish died. But if we see that fish either moving upstream or moving across the bay and whatnot, we're like, hey, this fish survived the tagging process. So typically researchers, once they get their data back, they're trying to get an idea of like, you know, how much of an impact did that process have on the fish? And then, you know, that of course determines how many fish you have at liberty.
Rodney emailed to ask how warming temperatures are affecting fish populations and if there are people studying that.
Yes. So like there are, you know, what are the effects of climate change, right? And, you know, what does it mean for the future? So that's a difficult question to answer because, you know, they're going to be fish populations are going to be affected differently. In general, younger fish actually prefer warmer water, right? They grow quicker. And, you know, it's like northern pike. Northern pike are typically considered to be a cold water fish or a cool water fish. But actually, when they're young, they love the warm water. So there are no conclusive results yet. But with respect to how, you know, changing temperatures may affect this. But a lot of these projects are trying to get an idea of, like, what is the spatial temporal that's in time and space distribution of these fish, you know, throughout their life cycle. So we don't have anything, you know, really conclusive yet, but that is how this telemetry is being used. And then the immediate, you know, questions we can ask are like, hey, because if lakes are warming up quicker, are they having to migrate longer distances to find that cold water refuge? And then does that negatively impact their survival? You know, everybody thought, you know, with the warming temperatures, you know, Lake Walleye and Lake Erie were going to be in a lot of trouble. But if you actually look at the recruitment records over the last decade, Lake Erie Walleye have been doing very, very well. A lot of strong hatches. So it's one of those things where we don't know exactly what the impact is, because it's likely going to vary for different life stages. And then, of course, with different species that are under consideration.
Yeah, here in Wisconsin, we're losing a lot of walleye. We're losing our walleye populations at the and probably at the expense of bass, smallies, smallmouth bass, and are increasing in numbers while walleye populations are diminishing. And, of course, I'm not talking about the Great Lakes here, but it's a real concern for many, many people.
Yeah, I'm familiar with quite a bit of that research. I believe University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, have been working on quite a bit of that research. They're actually very active in most of the telemetry projects in Green Bay. So yeah, yep, it is definitely a new phenomena. I think there's similar observations up in Canada, and seeing where this goes will certainly be interesting. I mean, keep in mind these systems are always very dynamic; they're not static, and so there's ebbs and flows. But it will be interesting to see how this plays out over the longer term.
I want to talk about some of the other individual research projects that are going on. So there's a lot of cool ones. I'm really a musky fisherman. I caught a lot of muskies in my life. And I'm always, I'm hopeful that maybe we'll get a world record out of Green Bay someday. There's some pretty big ones being caught there, but I know there's a musky... the Green Bay Fox River research project, I think that relates to muskie spawning.
Yeah, I have to admit that with all those projects, I am not as, probably in tune with all the the aspects of, that project. But you're right. It's looking at, I believe where they're spawning, and then also like what these fish are doing when temperatures maybe get too warm, for them to be in those shallow water environments. The muskie are interesting because, and they're actually a little bit of a challenge for our acoustic telemetry array, because if you take a look at your at those maps that you were referencing on our website, most of those receivers are deployed in the open water. When you get near shore and in shallow water, especially where there's a lot of vegetation, that's where the acoustic telemetry has a little bit more challenges. Because again, there's vegetation in the water and it thwarts the signal. So with that said, because we have such the wide coverage, if those fish are making cross bay movements, or even if they're only detected opportunistically, I think it has the opportunity to provide a lot of insight into their ecology. I know bringing it back maybe a little bit to Lake Erie real quick in the St. Clair system, quite a few walleye muskies that have been tagged in the St. Clair system have actually been detected in Lake Erie, and they almost like swim a lap around the lake and then go back out. And likely, they're out there searching for forage and also suitable temperatures. So it's really interesting. Like that's, again, one of the things, like there's no other tagging approach that could provide the information, that this acoustic telemetry would. Traditionally, biologists would go out, tag a fish with some type of external tag, and then maybe that fish would be recaptured by an angler at some point in the future. And they might know where it is either, 2 weeks after it was captured or 10 years. But it's like a point A and point B data set, right? Whereas with the telemetry, there's A, B, C, D, E, F, and a lot of different data points.
Well, let's say I catch a 60-inch muskie, and it's got a, or anybody else catches a tagged fish. I'm trying to think of a way that you'd be able to get that information or that data to you or whoever's doing the research.
Sure. So there's two ways that fish, you might know if that fish is marked. Now, let me just say from the onset, not all the fish that are tagged with these acoustic transmitters, are marked so that an angler would know it. Certainly if an angler were to cut a fish open, the transmitter would fall out if it's attached internally. But there are some studies where there's very low exploitation rates. And so, you wouldn't expect to catch one of these. So typically, if a researcher feels like their fish is going to potentially be harvested, like a walleye, like a white fish, like a lake trout, and I believe they're even doing this with smallmouth bass, they will put an extra tag in that fish, an external tag that protrudes out of the abdomen, under the stomach, and will say reward. And then they typically will offer $100, and then there will be a number to call that tag in. So what we encourage anglers to do is don't do anything that you wouldn't normally do, right? So if you never have thrown a legal walleye back in the water. Now, I know I'm on a Wisconsin show. I'd say that, that the chances of that are probably pretty high, right, Larry?
Yeah.
I mean, legal walleye rarely go back. Then we wouldn't want you to throw back that walleye with a transmitter, because we're able to actually use that information to say, hey, this is what our exploitation rates are. So we just want anglers to behave in the way that they typically would. So like if you've never ever harvested a smallmouth bass, then I would say don't harvest the smallmouth bass, put it back if it looks healthy. Now you could report the tag, because on the tag there's another little identifier, you know, and that would allow the researcher to know, oh, hey, I tagged that one on this day and it's still swimming around. So I guess, you know, in general, I can't speak for every researcher, but in generally we encourage anglers just to behave, if you would, the way they normally would. If you would normally harvest the fish, harvest it. If you don't, just release it and let it go.
I had some thoughts about managing and how managers might use the information that they receive. I was thinking about that Green Bay Fox River one with muskie spawning. If they can see where there are areas where eggs are being produced, you know, from a management perspective, look, okay, here's some areas where they're being produced, but they're not being produced over here. Why is that? Or how can we make this area even better for fish to actually lay their eggs?
You're absolutely right. So that's the whole impetus behind this, these type of studies. Again, depending upon what type of receiver configuration we're using. And so now we'll talk about a fine scale positioning, when I mentioned before, where I said we could estimate the coordinates of where a fish were, you know, its latitude and longitude versus the presence absence. So, you know, theoretically, like you say, if you had a bunch of receivers in this spawning habitat and we, you know, the researcher saw that it focused on this weed line or this type of habitat, they could say, oh, this seems to be very conducive. And so can we enhance that? Or can we, when we're designing new habitats, this is what we want to look at. A couple examples there. One is actually up in Lake Superior, where they were looking at restoring wild rice in some of the beds. They were looking at ways actually of how they could exclude carp, because carp are very destructive to wild rice. You know, and then what effect the carp had on the wild rice. So they were, you know, looking at their fine scale movements in and around the beds of wild rice. In Lake Erie, they had no idea where lake trout were spawning. And what they found is that they were actually spawning in habitats they weren't exactly expecting, is that they were spawning on the reef, but they're actually spawning on the leeward side on a much steeper slope than they would have expected. So it's really giving biologists more insight into like what type of habitat these fish are utilizing. Every biologist has some type of working idea of what they use, but the beauty of this is you're letting the fish tell you exactly what they're using.
Really interesting. Chris Vandergroot, our guest today, director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. Questions for him about the fish in the Great Lakes or about this research project, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at high-tech fish tracking and high-tech EV charging stations on the show today, but we're zeroing in now on the fish tracking with our guest, Christopher Vandergroot. Chris is director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System, operating throughout our Great Lakes. And we're talking about, really talking about the projects that are going on there. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions about fish or the fisheries in the Great Lakes. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. As I looked at the projects going on, we've got, you know, of course I zeroed in on the muskie spawning on Lake Michigan, but there's also lake trout spawning in Lake Michigan. There's also whitefish Taking a look at whitefish mortality and also Cisco, which is a big deal for a lot of reasons you may want to talk about.
Yeah, so let's start with the lake whitefish. Lake whitefish, you know, have had some pretty large population declines throughout the Great Lakes Basin, not just Lake Michigan, yeah. Lake Huron, Lake Erie. I think Lake Superior is actually holding fairly constant. I sometimes get them mixed up. But anyway, Lake Whitefish, you know, have had declines. And this is a pretty big concern, you know, A, from the ecological role that they fill, but also they're also a very popular food fish, right? Like who doesn't love smoked whitefish?
Yep.
You know, when you're traveling. So there's a great concern there. And so one of the things the researchers are doing, again, are trying to understand, you know, what are their survival rates? That's one of the things we use the telemetry data for, is that we're able to estimate survival rates by saying, hey, how many are alive at year 1, 2, 3, and 4? And so then why are those fish dying? Are they dying due to natural causes like disease or predation or something like that? Or are they dying due to fishing causes, right? So if they're dying due to associated with fishing, well, then harvest regulations can be amended and we can address those declines that way. If it's, due to disease and natural mortality, that's another, you know, presents another set of challenges. But really, biologists want to know why the fish are dying. So that's one of the reasons the telemetry is being done on the with Lake Whitefish. What's interesting, it sounds like they a lot of work is being done there in Green Bay. It sounds like, you know, there's fish that run up the rivers to spawn, and then there's also fish that utilize the main lake. So very interesting comparisons. And then with respect to the Cisco, like you mentioned, you want a 60-pound muskie in Green Bay. You want to root for a Cisco coming back, because those little things are very high in calorie, and they're usually very abundant, you know, when you've got good populations. And everything eats them. So again, that's the focus. And what's the interesting about Cisco is that there's what we call different phenotypes, or they do different things. There are some Cisco that are very shallow, near shore. Those were historically referred to as Lake Herring in Lake yeah. Erie. Then there are the deep water forms. Those are like your bloaters and things like that. So there are Ciscos that occupy the near shore environments, and then there are Cisco that occupy the offshore pelagic environment. So that's, again, managers and researchers are using the telemetry to better understand, you know, the habitat use of these different forms, and then as well as, you know, different stocking strategies. They're being reintroduced pretty actively in Green Bay right now, the Cisco. There are a lot of bloater being reintroduced into Lake Ontario. Lake Erie, I think, has also entered the discussion on trying to maybe reintroducing them. So there's quite a bit of work focusing on bringing back the Cisco. I mean, think about yeah. it. It's what they eat. You want yeah. native. You would want to have native forage for these fish to eat, and that provides the most stable forage base. And that's the role that Cisco fill in the Great Lakes ecosystem.
Yeah, very, very important. Ryan in Columbus has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. Very interested in this topic. I had a question about fish tagging, and I am a strictly catch and release fisherman, and I've always been curious if I'm catching the same fish or not. Probably the running joke. But is it possible to get trained or get materials, tagging equipment and get training to learn how to tag fish?
I'd have to have you refer to the, or it would be smart for me to refer you to the local management agencies that are doing the work. They typically have scientific sampling permits, you know, to do this work. Now, I will say a majority of the fish that receive these tags, we bring them on board once we catch them. We'll immobilize them or anesthetize them so that they're not, you know, flailing about. And then we need to suture these fish back up and release them. So it's quite involved, you know, actually. But I would say you should probably reach out to the individual researchers at the different state agencies who are conducting these studies.
Yeah, I've known guys who have clipped a fin or something and done some sort of way to do it that way, Ryan, but that's has its dangers too. But it's not a bad idea. The DNR, Wisconsin DNR, might be the place to go for some more information on that for sure. Chris, thank you for calling. Christina in Glenwood, will go to you. What's on your mind?
Hi there, thank you. I'm wondering what, if anything, have you learned about how the lamprey affects the fish population?
Yeah, that's been an ongoing my whole career when it comes to the Great Lakes.
So that's actually really interesting. With respect to how the lamprey affect the fish population, the telemetry hasn't really focused on that too much. It's been focusing more on what are the ways to better control these fish. So the telemetry has been used to say, hey, what's the efficiency of these different traps that are being used? Because a lot of times they use these traps up in the tributaries when these things go to spawn and they try to collect them there. And what there's been some really neat research where they've actually developed these pheromones that will either draw lamprey to one river where they can be trapped, or it repels them from others. So there's like a death pheromone and, you know, as you would say, an attraction pheromone. So the telemetry has been used to kind of evaluate these different approaches and then which one is most effective. I've been talking with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission and some of the folks who head up that research, and we think the time is now right, meaning we have enough receivers in some of these lakes where we could tag simultaneously sea lamprey and the fish that they typically impact, like whitefish and lake trout, and learn more how these two fish kind of move throughout the ecosystem together. So there's not been too much work on the direct effect of lamprey on these fish populations with the telemetry. It's more understanding the ecology of the lamprey and how they can tailor control efforts to control them.
You know, I'm thinking about the lampreys. It seems to me, and I'm thinking of over the course of my career here on Wisconsin Public Radio, from time to time it's come up, and I remember maybe back to when I first started, there seemed to be more concern. I mean, it seemed like the lampreys hit a peak at some point and then started going declining a bit. I don't know what you have in mind, Chris, what information you have on that and sort of the history of it.
Well, my supervisor is probably cringing right now because I am not a lamprey guy. But again, I've been involved with fisheries management in the Great Lakes since the early 2000s. And so each state or each lake has its target wounding rate on different fish. And typically it's lake trout or lake whitefish. Lake whitefish actually they don't think they sustain a lamprey attack very well. Like that, they probably die very quickly. But fish like lake trout can actually sustain an attack. And what they do is they look at like what fraction of the population has these scars from lamprey. So each lake has their own target levels. Now, I'll say the work that the Great Lakes Fishery Commission does in conjunction with both the Canadian and U.S. Governments to control these lamprey is impressive. There are crews that go out throughout the basin and implement control efforts every year, and they're out there right now. By and large, right now, those across the Great Lakes, I believe they're meeting their objective, like of keeping those attack rates low. So they have an idea of like, hey, when attack rates get too high, that's when we see a lot of fish mortality, and they kind of keep they shoot for some background level of marking rates, because the reality is they're never going to exclude all of them, because they're kind of spawning in some of these different smaller tributaries they may not know. But they're actively working when there's flare-ups in these different lakes and targeting those to keep them at, you know, if you could say, acceptable levels. I mean, one could argue no level is acceptable, mm-hmm. but the reality of the matter is that they're not going to be able to eradicate all of them. And so they're strategically working to keep these populations suppressed in each lake.
Wow. It's something we don't hear as very much or as much about as we once did, for sure. Which, as you look at thinking about the Great Lakes, which fish do you think are most in trouble?
Which ones are most in trouble? Well, right now, the news on Lake Whitefish is somewhat disconcerting. The recruitment patterns, that is the number of young fish that are showing up in the surveys, is pretty low. The question is that due to, again, things like fishing or climate change, or is it kind of the result of zebra mussels working their way up the lakes? If you recall, zebra mussels were first identified, I believe, in Lake Erie, you know, way back when.
Yeah.
And they've been slowly making their way up into the upper lakes. And I think the concern in the upper lakes is you already have reduced nutrients in the upper lakes because you don't have as much agricultural area. And so whatever nutrients are there are what juvenile lake whitefish, as well as other fish, need to survive. And so the thought there is that if zebra mussels get in and reduce those nutrients even further, that could be very detrimental. There's no smoking gun. There's still a lot of research ongoing, but that is one of the current hypotheses being evaluated.
Yeah, zebra mussels are awful. Are there any others along with zebra mussels that are creating problems for the fishery?
You know, it's interesting you say that because I remember when I started on Lake Erie, everybody was really, really concerned about gobies. You know, they had just gotten in. And the reality of it is of course, the population of gobies skyrocketed. But then the funny thing is that everything learned, these are pretty good to eat. And then you start seeing them in all sorts of fish diets. And now, you know, again, you don't see the high abundance of gobies in Lake Erie like you used to, because the predators have figured out, oh, we can eat these. And so I think that's kind of been a similar scenario that's been playing itself out. As they come in, fish figure out how to eat them. I think one of the most troublesome, aside from the Asian carp, topic, the common carp are actually fairly detrimental. And I don't think people realize that just because we've had them for so many years. And the detriment of them is that they go into these near shore areas that are very sensitive, and they're just constantly uprooting the vegetation, which increases the turbidity of the water, which decreases the amount of light that's penetrating, which then decreases the amount of phytoplankton and zooplankton, which young fish need to survive. So, you know, I would say if there's one on my hit list, I would say common carp probably are more the biggest ecological disaster, you know, that, you know, aside from the alewives, you know, that were back in the 50s and so on, you know, when they proliferated, you know, current day, I would say, you know, the big heads and silvers carp, we definitely don't want to see them here. But modern day, I would say common carp are pretty rough for the environment.
Yeah, and I know we do netting in the lake systems, the inland lake system. It'd be a lot harder to do it in the Great Lakes, and I don't imagine.
They do it in places like Lake Erie. They have big seine operations, and I'm convinced you could put a saddle on some of those carp that they haul up because they are very, very large. Anyway.
How do people find out more about the GLaDOS, or the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System?
So the easiest way would just to be to type GLaDOS in your search or your browser, GLATOS. If you want to go directly to the site, you can go to glados.gloss.us. So that would be glados.glos.us, and that will take you to the web page. The web page is pretty boring in some respects because it's really built for the researchers where they're uploading their data and where they're archiving their data. But there, as you discovered, there's quite a few project descriptions on there.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting to me, and I know it will be to a lot of other people as well. Chris, a great pleasure. Thank you for taking a whole hour to talk with us. I really appreciate it, and maybe we can do this again down the road. Thank you, Chris.
Anytime. Appreciate you having us on.
Chris Vandergroot is the director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. Well, coming up, we're going to be taking a look at Wisconsin's new alternative fuel corridor. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us and spending some of your time with us on WPR News today. Larry Mueller here. Going to take a closer look now at Wisconsin's new alternative fuel corridor and look at EV cars as well with our guest, Caleb Vanderweel. Caleb is the Transportation Electrification Project Manager for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. And as we talk with Caleb, I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about the new EV charging stations or information about EV autos? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Caleb Vanderweel, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Larry, thank you for having me on today.
Let's just start by talking about the corridor itself. We've been hearing about this alternative fuel corridor for quite a while. Maybe the background on the project and where are we with it?
So the alternative fuel corridor system, it's a system of highways across the country, but specifically here in Wisconsin, that were created under a previous federal law around 2016, where the state of Wisconsin worked with the Federal Highway Aid Administration to designate certain interstates, state highways, and U.S. highways to support alternative fuels, including electric vehicle charging. Fast forward a couple years to the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. The Bipartisan Infrastructure Law provides Wisconsin approximately $78 million to fund construction of electric vehicle charging stations on this alternative fuel corridor system. For us in Wisconsin, that alternative fuel corridor system includes all of the state's interstates. What's a little bit unique about Wisconsin's approach compared to other states is we also designated a system of both state highways and U.S. highways as well to increase where we're able to fund these charging stations in the state of Wisconsin. So this includes State Highway 29 from Green Bay to Eau Claire, U.S. 41, U.S. 141, and then across the northern part of the state, U.S. 8, U.S. 2. We also have State Highway 53 up to Superior and U.S. 51 as well. So altogether, we have about 2,000 miles of highways where we're able to fund electric vehicle charging stations, which have to be within one travel mile of that highway system.
And, you know, these chargers are pretty important to the state. I was just listening to our newscast and the fact that, for example, that tourism has reached new highs in terms of dollars from tourists. I got to believe that would be one of the benefits of, you know, getting these charging stations everywhere. If you've got, say you're from Illinois and you've got an electric car, you want to know that I can get to Door County or I can get to Superior without much trouble.
That's absolutely the focus. And when we think about what types of chargers that we are intending to fund under this federal program, we're funding level 3 DC fast chargers, which are the charging activity that's going to be about 20 to 40 minutes that really acts to support both inner city and interstate travel. You know, if you're from, again, Milwaukee, and you want to go to somewhere like Superior or Eagle River, this is the type of charging station that you're going to utilize to be able to complete that type of travel. But when we think about tourism, the main challenge with electric vehicles in the state today really is a lack of availability for publicly available charging stations. When we think about, we look at the system, we have a decent amount of chargers that are publicly available, again, outside of the home. In the Milwaukee area, you know, the Milwaukee suburbs, Dane County, some up through the valley to Green Bay. But really, as you leave urban and suburban areas in the state of Wisconsin, many rural counties have yet to see even an individual publicly available charger. This program will work to start to put chargers in a lot of counties where there currently are no publicly available chargers.
Yeah. Larry in Delavan has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Larry. Thank you for calling.
That's fine. I enjoy my electric Rivian, but I only use it for less than 300-mile trips. I haven't been successful charging on the road anywhere, but it charges overnight at home. Great. And I don't think that our grid system can handle everyone having electric vehicles. They've got to upgrade it before it'd be good for everyone. And years ago, they had electric taxi cabs in Spain. It's on YouTube. You can watch it. They pull in and they lift the whole front end of the taxi cab off, and they have a crane comes in and picks up a huge lead acid battery out of it and puts in a charged one. And that works great. But I think all the electric vehicles, they should go to a standardized battery where you can pull into a battery station, and in 5 to 10 minutes, they swap out your battery. And that way you don't own the battery, and that makes the vehicles cheaper, because about a third the cost of an electric vehicle is the battery.
Larry, you raise a lot of points here, worthy for sure of discussion. Caleb, what do you think? Larry brought up updating our electric system. You know, the system itself. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that's beneficial about where we are in the transition to electric vehicles today, currently, we're only around about 23,000 registered electric vehicles in the state of Wisconsin. That's still far less than a percent of the overall passenger vehicles in the state. So we're really just starting this process. So the time exists for when that grid does need to be upgraded and where it needs to be upgraded for that to happen over time. Again, we're seeing a little bit of a change in the transition. It has started to pick up in the last couple of years. Just a few years ago, we only had about 9,000 electric vehicles. So they're starting to come to the system. But moving there to I think one of your later comments, you know, there are a lot of interesting technologies that are coming forward. You talked about battery replacement as a potential option. We know that there's some in industry looking at that issue. You know, for us and the types of chargers that we're funding under the program, we're seeing a lot of changes in the industry as well. When we started preparing for our program a couple years ago, we were looking at, you know, funding the CCS charging port. We still intend to fund that port on our locations, but as we've worked through program development, the Tesla-style NACS connectors has been where industry is moving towards, and as a result, we're moving our program towards that direction. But I think it's an important point that, you know, this technology is going to change as we work to develop this program, and it will be interesting to see where industry ends up, especially when it comes to technology such as battery replacement.
Yeah, the whole business about driving in and getting your battery replaced as what Larry was saying happens in Spain. Maybe that's another. I mean, you know, I have an Eagle lawnmower, a trimmer, and a blower, and they all operate on the same battery, and I can pull a battery out in a minute and put the new one, move it from the lawnmower to the blower, for example, with minimal problem. You think there's any chance that might ever happen here with cars?
So not that we've seen so far, but we have seen some conversations about the technology. You know, specifically, you know, he mentioned a taxi cab company. When it comes to, you know, fleet type vehicles where you own a lot of vehicles and you have to have a quick transition to keep that vehicle on the road, that's one instance where, you know, we've seen some feasibility of it being a potential. For passenger vehicles, we've seen some conversation of the concept, but haven't seen any real ideas yet to date.
Yeah. And I, you know, and the manufacturers are going to have to get together on this almost, you got to believe, wouldn't you? I mean, on a system that you can use, that every car has that can be used anywhere.
Absolutely. And I was talking about the different types of connectors already. You know, there's already efforts to try to work to some standardization of some of the items and some of the components. You know, you've never pulled up to a gas pump with a gas car and have that gas pump not fit into your vehicle. You know, when we think about traditional vehicles, certain things have been standard, you know, across all vehicle types for a long time. Think about, you know, the three-position seatbelt as an example. When we think about electric vehicles, we're going to have to see some of this happen across that industry as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. Caleb Vanderweel, our guest today, the Transportation Electrification Project Manager for the Wisconsin DOT. It's great to have him with us. And questions for him, I hope you'll join in with your comments. Number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the transportation electrification project that's going on in Wisconsin with Caleb Vanderweel, who is manager of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation project on this. Great to have him with us. Join in. You can email us to talk@WPR.org or phone in at 1-800-642-1234. Jordan in Langlade County has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jordan.
Hi there, folks. Thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with power generation. You know, right now we have 23,000 odd electric vehicles in the state. But, you know, if this catches on and we, you know, in a couple of years have 230,000 or 2.3 million of these vehicles on the road, where are we going to get that electricity that isn't, you know, hauling more coal out of the earth or digging for more oil? What are we going to do as far as developing that power so that we can actually make steps towards this being an effective program?
All right. Jordan, thanks for calling. Caleb?
Jordan, thank you for the question. So we have a couple things to consider, and it's that initial generation of that power. You know, one of the things that, you know, I think we've seen as a benefit, you know, a substantial amount of our grid is powered by fossil fuels. But over time, we've seen some of that dial begin to turn towards other types of renewables, towards natural gas. You know, that's going to have to be, you know, part of that conversation as we transition you not only to electric vehicles, but to other parts of electrification. You know, when we think about people who have an electric stove or maybe an electric heat pump, you know, there's a lot of items that we as consumers purchase that have moved towards that electrification. You know, Larry mentioned, you know, some of his garden tools as another example. So when we think about that generation, you know, we have to ensure that over time that that dial is being tuned up. And to, again, to a lot of people's efforts to, you know, ensure potentially that, you know, some of that fuel source is cleaner. Because, again, when you look at some of the grid today, it is very heavily fossil fuel oriented. But when we think about, you know, electric vehicle charging, you know, our department perspective is less on the focus of the generation of that power, but the distribution of it. Attempting to fund electric vehicle charging, especially in more rural parts of the state of Wisconsin, not only do we need that generation capacity, but we need distribution in place to be able to get that electricity to those charging stations. The department's funding level 3 DC fast charging stations, and the goal is to fund 4 charging ports at 150 kilowatts per hour at each location. So at 600 kilowatts per location is a fairly substantial distribution of electricity. And this comes back to the planning effort that the department had to undertake to be able to deploy these charging stations. We looked at our alternative fuel corridor system, looked at 2,000 miles of that system of interstates, U.S. highways, and a state highway. And we had to complete analysis that showed where we have not only generation, but distribution in place to be able to place charging stations. So when you look at our tentative locations for our program, we have 53 project locations across the state of Wisconsin. Very excited to have those projects be distributed very diversely across the state of Wisconsin in each corner of the state. But when you look at the areas where we're funding charging stations, we're funding them where there's already substantial commercial activity near big box retail, near truck stops, near gas stations, near restaurants, and oftentimes a basket of amenities at a location, a few restaurants, a few gas stations, a big box retail store or two. The more commercial activity we have in a location, the more likely we are to have that distribution of that electricity at that location to be able to support that charging station.
Yeah, actually, Jim had emailed him wondering about restaurants. Would there be, they would be a prime location for recharging stations. Wondering about, is the cost of installing these so high that this won't happen? But it sounds like some of this is going to happen.
So cost is the main concern. And when the department, we started looking at electric vehicles a little bit later than other states, around, winter of 2021, when the conversation of the bipartisan infrastructure law began. And at that time, we had to determine, what would be the department's role in the conversation on electric vehicles. And we quickly determined in some conversations with industry that the cost barriers to providing electric vehicle charging as being one of the main considerations for industry and their ability to deliver charging stations. This is where I think that federal investment comes into play and into that conversation. The federal investment in many of the areas where we are funding these charging stations is really the only opportunity for these locations to get to a return on investment on that charging station. The state of Wisconsin's not going to be owning and operating charging stations under this program. Rather, we're giving the dollars out as a grant to private site host owners and operators. So under our first 53 projects, we have some locations that many Wisconsinites will know, but they're mostly mostly gas convenience. We'll have a charging station at a gas station right next to the Thorpedo restaurant in Thorpe, Wisconsin. The Pine Cone in Johnson Creek will have charging stations. So we got to some really exciting locations, but mostly gas and fuel retail. We do have, again, a couple restaurants. We have about five hotels that we will be placing these charging stations at, and then an attraction as well. But again, not having the state own and operate under this program, we thought was a prudent idea. And again, our goal is to really incentivize private industry to not only own and operate charging stations under this program, but to be able to do so in the future after the federal dollars have been used.
And I heard you say like four charging stations. I was going to ask about that, and someone else had wondered in an email, what if you get to the gas station, there's only one there, and there's like three cars in line waiting to get power.
So that's a really important consideration. Leaning into the program a couple years ago, the federal government, I think, was correct in understanding that a lot of publicly available charging so far has been fairly unreliable. It's that either that one charging port or two, yeah. Oftentimes not in a great location. If you only have one charging station on your route to a destination and you get to that charging station, it's not operational, that can really ruin your day. So there is a federal standard in place governing the use of these dollars that requires us at each location for there to be the ability for four vehicles to all charge at 150 kilowatt hour apiece at the same time.
Dan in central Wisconsin has something I think relates a bit. Let's go there. Dan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
All right. Well, I've been an EV owner for 7 years now,
And one of the things that I'd like to say is that we also have solar panels on our house, and some of your callers are making an excellent argument for going with renewable energy. We drive on sunshine most of the time. The other thing I want to say is that, like a lot of EV drivers, we don't use the interstate system because going 70 miles an hour uses your battery up fairly fast by comparison with going 55, 57, 58. So we tend to use two-lane roads, and that's where I'd like to see more charging stations placed. The other thing, the other recommendation I have is we ought to have charging stations at all the state parks, because and they don't have to be level three chargers. They can be level two chargers. If you're going to be spending a few hours somewhere, the expense of a level two charging station versus a level three is very, very different. Level two chargers are very inexpensive to put in. So that's my comment.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Well, Caleb, what do you think?
Excellent points. So the caller talked a lot about the state highway system and that two-digit system. I'm a motorist who likes to use the two-digit and the three-digit system as well as I travel the state. That was part of our consideration when we thought about where to place charging stations under our program. We did an analysis, and we have a publicly stated goal that we believe that 85% of that state highway system, you will be within 25 miles of a charging station on this under this program. So even if you're choosing to utilize that two-digit highway system, you'll still be able to come across a charging station under our program, and that's one of our stated goals. Talking a little bit about destination charging as well is really, really important. Under our program, the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, our focus is primarily that on route travel on your way to a destination. And usually when you're trying to get to a destination, you're trying to get to that destination. So you don't want to spend an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours charging your vehicle. You want to spend, 20 to 40 minutes, and you want to be on your way. But when you're at a destination, especially a destination, we're going to have some dwell time, a few hours, that does open up the door to opportunities for slower types of charging that can be much more both cost efficient from a construction perspective, but also cost efficient from the perspective of supporting that charging, given that there might be reduced grid capacity because you might be in a far rural area. So that's also part of, I think, the future conversation.
We should actually mention, we've talked about levels here, and one and three and two have all come up. Maybe Caleb, go back and explain those levels.
So we functionally have three levels of charging that we bring into conversations. Level one and level two charging, just keeping it as simple as possible, is potentially that charging activity in your home garage overnight. Not only is it a very cost-efficient installation from the few hundred to the few thousand dollars, but also that electricity that you're drawing through that level one or level two charger is going to be very cost efficient for you as that EV driver. Back of the napkin math we like to talk about, if you're charging your vehicle at home at night in your home garage, we're thinking you're going to be at about 20% on the comparison to a gallon of gasoline. Level three fast charging is a little bit of a different ball game. You go from kind of the few hundred, few thousand to projects that are in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to deploy. In some states, their NEVI projects are over the $1 million mark in some location. But that all builds to that convenience of that speed of that electricity into that electric vehicle. Level three charger, again, working towards maybe a half hour charging activity, but with that capital cost of that construction, that there's also that substantial draw on electricity. So electricity through a level three fast charging station sometimes can be, that equivalent cost of that gallon of gasoline. So as a result, EV motorists tend to utilize level three fast chargers, again, for when they have that need of convenience for longer distance travel.
Yeah. And the level one, you get about, 1 to 2.5 miles per hour of charge, and the level two, 10 to 60 miles per hour of charge. Is that's about right, I believe.
It's roughly correct. Level one can be about 5 miles per hour. You can plug a level one charger into a standard 120 volt outlet. A level two charger, you're going to need a 240 volt outlet, but you're going to be able to get to, you know, 20 to 60 miles an hour for that charge. You know, level three, generally, we look to about 60 to 100 miles for every 20 minutes of that charging activity.
Yeah, and so if, like for homeowners, might be for a lot of people, it'd be worth it just to, okay, level one's going to be fine for me, but others may need to call the electrician and have a little bit of money there to set up so they would be able to use the level two.
Absolutely. We hear anecdotes of EV users that they get home and they have that option to go install that level two charger. They plug in the level one and that's all they ever use and they never upgrade. We hear that sometimes. But, you know, an important point to make, and this is some of the culture change that I think the department at this point is supporting, is most EV users. And our first caller, he mentioned this, the fact that he only charges at home and he rarely, if ever, charges on the public system. You know, that's great for those users. You know, when you can get to 75, 80, 90% of your charging at home in your garage, that makes owning an EV a little bit more cost efficient. But that's also part of the case in many instances across Wisconsin, because many individuals who have chosen to purchase an electric vehicle may potentially live in a county that has no publicly available charging. And I've heard and had a couple conversations the last few months or so with individuals who wanted to still live in rural Wisconsin and own an electric vehicle, and they've chosen to do so, and they have yet to charge outside of their home because they have nowhere to charge.
Mm. Tony in the town of Madison emailed that tonight at the Fitchburg Library, there will be an EV 101 event. It goes from 6 to 7:30 with a short presentation by an MGE representative, MG&E. And then they'll go outside to allow individuals attending to see and ask questions of the owners who will have their vehicles there. So nice little event in the town of Madison tonight, the Fitchburg Library. David and Sherwood, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I live in a multi-tenement building, you know, so charging is a problem for me. I have to go to a public charger right now. But I've been doing a lot of research, and there are energy management systems that allow the EV charger to ramp up or slow down the charging rate on an individual vehicle based on usage rates. So if I were using my own meter, I could still charge even though I only have a 125 amp service, because all I have to do is set it up to charge at a certain time when I know I won't be using as much capacity, and it will not charge until there's enough capacity there. And then it will charge while there's capacity. So I think, you know, a lot of us think in terms of a glass half empty, but actually that glass is also half full.
Yeah. Yeah. Comment on that, Caleb?
Yeah, that's absolutely the way we look at it. And it goes back to some of the conversations about, you know, the energy systems that make up our grid, or, you know, we talk about what's currently available and potential for charging. You know, we're seeing systems like the caller just discussed that are you know, provide some potential for some real cost efficiency for that user. And we're really excited to see some of these things come forward. And again, it kind of leans into, you know, we hope that what WISDOT is working towards in supporting these fast chargers and with industry across the state of Wisconsin, that you know, conversation that someone might have as a family thinking about purchasing an electric vehicle, that they're able to start seeing some of the things that are out there that, you know, if they want to make that decision, that they're able to do so with some confidence.
Yeah. Thanks, David. Appreciate the call. Kendall in Merrill, will you go to you next? Hi, Kendall.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, initially, I wanted to talk about where the minerals and metals for the batteries for electric vehicles are sourced. Because if our goal is to help the environment in this global in our global reality, we need to be aware of, you know, how we're affecting the whole world. And even if we might be saving a little bit of air pollution here, the mines where the metals are extracted, they're left in devastation, as well as the humanitarian considerations, because the people doing the mining are not protected from the toxic effects, et cetera. So that's one thing to address. And then the other thing, as I've been listening to the conversation, is the fact that so many people live in apartments or trailer, you know, mobile homes. They have no garage. They have no, probably no way to charge at home. So I've heard rumor of, oh, this percentage of our vehicles on the road need to be electric by a certain year. Well, how do those people get to drive? And it seems like the government also is competing with private sector, who's providing gas. You know, we have gas stations all over. I can get gas anywhere I want in my with the current situation. I can fuel my car in a matter of minutes.
Yeah.
And if you try to force people to use electric, it just seems like it's going to be not convenient and not even possible for many people. So those are a lot of issues to consider. Thank you for your time.
All right, Kendall, thanks for calling. Well, she raised a few issues there. Caleb, comments?
Yeah, I'll dive in on the multi-unit dwelling conversation. You know, this is one of the things that is constantly brought up in conversations with stakeholders around the state of Wisconsin. You know, I think something about 30% of Wisconsinites are renters, oftentimes in those multi-unit dwellings where, you know, they're not going to have that easy outlet either on the side of their house to run that extension cable to their vehicle or in their garage. So I think that's a big part of the conversation moving forward is how we begin to answer some of that question. You know, one of the things that we have as a perspective in our program, as it is a federal program, is a drive from the federal administration to support 40% of the dollars utilized under this program in disadvantaged communities. And that is something that we've taken very seriously as a department. Out of the 53 projects that we're funding, 15 of those projects have been proactively cited in disadvantaged communities to begin to support charging in communities that currently do not have access to charging. One other thing that we're very excited about as a department, we're the first and only state under the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program to be funding projects with tribal governments. We have two tribal projects under our program, which we are also very excited about. To the point on, you know, the public sector competing with the private sector, if there's, you know, the thing that keeps you up at night, this is the one for me. You know, we as the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, we've never owned and operated gas pumps as far as I can find. And really, we don't want to be owning and operating charging stations as well. We're not going to be installing charging stations at our rest areas and our waysides. We believe that the fueling industry and private industry that currently exist across the state are best suited to be owning and operating these charging stations. And we really view the federal dollars that we have as an incentive for that private industry. As we started to think about this program the last couple of years, we really immediately found ourselves in conversations with a lot of businesses across the state that have said to us, hey, we would like to provide and we would like to sell electricity and we'd like to own and operate charging stations. We just can't get to that return on investment. So we do really view these dollars and funding these charging stations at private locations that they are going to own and operate themselves as a way for the public sector to be involved here for a little bit, but then step away and allow the private sector to continue to own and operate.
And in terms of the ethics, I'm, you know, there's a trade-off between, I mean, there's ethics involved with gasoline, I think, as well as the materials that Kendall was talking about, mining materials that need to be used for batteries.
And when it comes to materials, you know, I think this this space is ever constant changing, and it's just as comparative to, you know, we talk about the fuel sources that fuel our grid. Over time, it's going to change. You know, we had some news out of Pennsylvania recently about lithium discoveries in Pennsylvania, where there might be lithium resources that may be fairly easily accessible. You know, this is something where, you know, there are significant concerns, especially when we look at some of the countries where some of this material comes from. That's going to have to be part of the conversation moving forward.
Yeah. Kendall, thanks again. Appreciate it. Caleb Vanderweel, our guest today, Transportation Electrification Project Manager for the Wisconsin DOT. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at Wisconsin's alternative fuel corridor with our guest, Caleb Vanderweel. Thank you so much for joining in. Lots of callers online with questions. There's a line open at 800-642-1234, or by all means, email to talk@wpr.org. Wayne in Green Bay, we go to you next. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I picked up my Tesla Model Y in June of 22, and the very next month, I took a trip, business trip, down to Atlanta, Georgia. All I had to do was punch in my motel address, and it gave me the entire route with all the charging stations I needed. I took 2 days going down. I had to charge twice a day. Slept in my car the first night on the way down and on the first night on the way back. Camping in your car is an electric vehicle is a thing because you don't have a gas engine and worry about fumes. It can keep the temperature constant through the night. It was simple as could be. There was plenty of charging stations. I never was in doubt of being able to find one. They've expanded the charging stations in Wisconsin quite a bit over those 2 years. I mean, you've got Marinette, Wausau, Stevens Point just opened up, Sheboygan, Manitowoc, Appleton, Minocqua. There's plenty of charging, or I shouldn't say plenty, but quite a few out there. And they're strategically put so that if you're on the highway that, you know, every, at least I would say 30 to 50 miles, there's another charging station available somewhere. So I wouldn't be afraid of that. Also, a comment on the charging. Somebody was talking about, you know, where is the electricity going to come from? I believe it also, charging your car at night, the rates are much less. And that's when the grid has the most electricity available. So it kind of balances the grid, I think, a little bit. My car has around a 75-kilowatt battery. And the average cost in Wisconsin is 16 cents a kilowatt when you're paying from your house. So it only takes $12 to fill my car from 0 to 100. So it's very economical.
And how far does your car go on a fill, let's call it?
Well, like the other caller, it said highway driving reduces. It's kind of just the opposite of gas, where gas gets more efficient because of the gearing, even though wind resistance does affect them too. But wind resistance is the only thing that affects electric vehicles. So I would say it was rated 303 miles when I picked it up. I would say technically between 250 in that area right now. But, you know, for your daily driving to and from work, I live 8 miles from my house and back and forth. Today I came to work and then I went down to Manitowoc, came back. I still have like 45% of my power left, no problem. So you go home, you plug it into your garage, and I'm lucky enough to have a garage. When you wake up in the morning the next day, you got a full car. Every day it's full.
Yeah. Wayne, thank you so much for calling. Comment, Caleb?
Yeah, you know, these anecdotes are really helpful in our conversations that we have about EV. When we talk with so many people who, you know, they may have seen EV covered in a negative light, their main concern with electrification and electric vehicles is range anxiety. You know, am I going to be able to go to where I want to desire to drive to as a motorist? And, you know, we hear examples like we just heard now, really shows that even longer distance travel in many places in the U.S., charging is available and does work. You know, we're hopeful for, you know, the program that the department's funding that we can get these types and that quality of charging just to more areas that it hasn't been able to get to so far.
Yeah, Wayne, thank you so much for calling. Jerry in Whitehall, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, excuse me. Pardon me.
Yeah, go ahead, Jerry. Jerry was calling. He loves his Kia Hybrid and wonders why not just go with one of those.
You know, we've seen a lot of conversation about, you know, and we've talked a lot about fully electric vehicles, but plug-in hybrids can also be a really awesome part of the equation. And, you know, as we've seen some market forces move back and forth over the last couple of years, we're seeing, you know, some additional interest in our auto manufacturers to look back into those types of plug-in hybrids. And what's great with a plug-in hybrid is, you do have that backup gas engine. So your range is a little bit more expanded in that instance.
Tony in Middleton emailed to ask approximately when will those first round 53 EV fast charging locations be operational? Also, what's the plan regarding the remaining federal funds that are available to Wisconsin under the IRA bill? He believes the funds allocated are over $70 million, and in this first round is for $23 million.
Those are all great questions. So we have 53 projects selected. For those paying attention to the economy that's around us, there are still supply chain concerns. So that utility transformer, sourcing that charging station, getting to construction, in some instances is going to take some time. We have a handful of projects that will be operational this year. We are looking at an October operational date for a couple of them. Many of the projects that we're funding will be operational in 2025. And then out of those 53, there will be a couple that will come online in early of 2026. But it'll take time for all of them to be online. One of the things where we are very happy about is the cost efficiency of our program. We were given through the federal formula approximately $78 million. So far, under these 53 projects, we are only spending $23 million of that funding. Under the federal rules for the program, after we build out this alternative fuel corridor system, we're then allowed to take that remaining money, move off the alternative fuel system, and fund projects in communities across Wisconsin, both level 3 charging stations, as well as the federal rule does allow us to fund level 2 charging stations off of that system as well. So as we work towards finalizing the build out of our system, we'll start the conversation about how the state can best meet needs off of the alternative fuel corridor system.
Mickey emailed to ask if you're aware of all the standalone off-the-grid solar charging stations that Polaris is putting up across the UP over Michigan. Mickey thinks it's pretty exciting.
No, I am not, but it's interesting to see, you know, how the demand for charging is being met. An interesting anecdote from a while ago, a local utility decided to see what would happen if they put a charging station basically in the middle of nowhere. And the day after it was operational, somebody had found it and was already charging. So if you build it, they will come, is some of the mentality we think about when we think about some of these rural areas. But, you know, that dovetails back into tourism and really, EV motorists, they want to get out, they want to adventure, and they want to be able to get to places. And we're hoping with some of these additional locations and some of them that will be on fairly soon, they'll be able to get to where they want to go.
Thinking about, I do not own an electric car right now, but I'm thinking about the glory of never having oil changes or no spark plugs to worry about or no timing belt to worry about. And that all goes away with an all-electric car, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Let's go to Mark and Nina. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Your guest suggested that like a level 1 and level 2 charging station was like 20% of the cost of gas per I guess, per mile or whatever. And then he said that the level threes are a lot more expensive. And I'm an electrical engineer, and I mean, electricity costs what electricity costs no matter how fast you're using it. So I don't, does that cost include the amortization of the installation? Is that why it costs so much, or is there something else?
That capital construction. So you go from a charging station, you know, that may have been a few hundred to a few thousand dollar installation to a capital construction project of $500,000 to $1 million. Meeting that return on investment means that that owner operator of that charging station has to price that electricity in accordance with what that activity getting to that point had cost that business.
There you go, Mark. Thanks for that call. Bill in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I have a question. How come the cars are not producing their own electricity to charge the batteries? You have an alternator on your car now that charges your battery, so why don't they have an alternator on both back wheels?
So there is braking technology that does recycle some of that electricity in some electric vehicles, and I know in some hybrid vehicles. So some of that is coming into play and is part of the conversation.
Yeah, so it's there, or it's getting there, Bill. Thank you. David in New Richmond, your turn. Hi, David.
Hey, imagine if everyone could afford an electric vehicle, if they got to be cheap enough where everyone could have one in Wisconsin to use in the summertime, and where would we ever get vehicles that would be produced cheap enough for everyone to afford them?
So, you know, this is a thing that is kind of core to the transition to electric vehicles. The cost of lithium batteries has substantially been reduced over the last 15 years. When you go back and you look at the start of the electrification conversation, you know, late 2000s, heading towards about 2010, you know, there were substantial cost barriers to those batteries. Those have steadily come down. We've seen cost of electric vehicles steadily come down. Right now, there are federal tax incentives. If you purchase a new electric vehicle that qualifies under the program, $7,500, it's at point of sale. You don't have to wait until you do your taxes to get that benefit. And then there's also a $4,000 benefit if you purchase a used electric vehicle. But with that in hand, with, again, some prices starting to come down, we're seeing some of those base model electric vehicles now be cheaper than an equivalent gas car. And that was something that wasn't seen 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, David, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate the call. Someone brought up that some states are working toward a ban of gas-powered cars. Any chance Wisconsin is headed that way, the writer wonders.
No, you know, there's some states that have put, you know, fairly aggressive goals on, you know, where they would like to be with electrification. We took a little bit of a different approach. You know, we believe by supporting publicly available charging that's privately owned and operated. We believe that, you know, we are hoping to help people make a decision of whether or not they want to purchase an electric vehicle, but we have not set any type of goal, deadline, or requirement.
Yeah, that makes sense, I think, for Wisconsin. And safety? That was another question. What about the safety of this whole process?
So when it comes to I'll talk specifically about charging stations. When we get asked about safety, it's this idea of, hey, you might be sitting at your vehicle at night late for an hour waiting for it to recharge. Have you considered safety? And yes, we absolutely have. So working with private industry, many of our locations are at business locations that are open 18 hours a day. Over 40 of our project locations are at businesses that are open 24/7. So many of our locations, over 40, if you're there charging, There will be an attendant at that business, so that business is also occupied. We also consider lighting and placement of those charging stations, ADA accessibility, again, ensuring that there's quality to that charging. One of the first anecdotes we heard in planning our program was a charging station that was at a location that was placed next to a dumpster, not really a great charging experience, not really what we're looking for here. But again, we believe, you know, charging stations that are at businesses that are open 24 hours a day are a great way to address some of that concern.
Caleb, been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Caleb Vanderweel, Transportation Electrification Project Manager for the Wisconsin DOT. It's great to have him with us, and we'll keep you up to date on it as we move along. Big thanks to our team effort, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and of course, Clara and Joel are our producers. Great to have you with us. Stay with us on WPR News.